greed is good. That's what a character called Gordon Gekko said in the film Wall Street. It was all about a go-getting young man in Wall Street and about how far he'd go to get what he wanted. And what he and others did was justified by that slogan, greed is good. Greed was meant to be good because it was the key to personal fulfillment. You could be a complete human being by indulging yourself however you liked. And anything you did on the way to that was fine, because the end justified the means. A greedy man was a good man because he'd fulfilled himself, according to that character, Gordon Gekko. A greedy man was also a good man for the rest of us, for society, because he was a market for us, according to Gekko. We could sell him exotic meals, very exotic if I've been doing the cooking, strange entertainments, pander to his greed in 1,001 ways, and be wealthy because of his greed, and use that wealth to be fulfilled in our turn. That was Gekko's creed. Greed is good. It's one that in the 90s in the United Kingdom, we're not so struck with. We associate it quite a bit with the 80s. But in fact, as we look at Isaiah chapter 5 tonight, we'll see that the creed of greed is a timeless one. And we'll see how the consequences of greed are timeless too. Over the last few weeks, we've been looking at what Isaiah had to say about the Judah of his day, the Judah of the 8th century before Christ. We've seen how he analyzes and looks through the religious life of his time in chapter 1. We've looked also at the criticisms that he's mounted of the leadership of his day. And we felt the shoe pinching sometimes as we've applied what he says to our own time. And we're looking again at something else tonight. Isaiah's focus shifts again. He's describing for us this time what's going on in the commercial and economic life of Judah. What people do also to relax and to unwind, how they spend their leisure. And perhaps it's just there that we feel how immediate his words are for us. Business and pleasure, commerce and leisure. That's pretty close to the heartbeat of the 20th century, don't you think? And for Isaiah, one thing that marks out the business and the pleasure of Judah is greed. First of all, in verses 8 to 10, there's a greed for wealth, isn't there? Just look at verse 8. Woe to those who join house to house, who add field to field, until there is no more room and you are made to dwell alone in the midst of the land. Well, at first glance, it's pretty obscure, but what's he describing? He's talking about the way that one man gradually buys out the house, the farm, the land of his neighbor. Gradually making what was once a mosaic of small holdings into one large agribusiness. Now, at first glance, you can think of loads of good reasons why people should do just that. After all, it makes for efficient use of the land, doesn't it? It maximizes output. It'll mean that as a whole, Judah will be a more prosperous society, with more corns on the cob per head than the kingdom next door. And there certainly are all kinds of signs of prosperity in the first bit of the 8th century in Judah. Judah's economy was on the move. Standards of living for the rich certainly were on the up. The recessions of the past were a thing of the past. There was a trend to gracious living. News agents were selling more copies of Good Housekeeping and Country Life. Now, if it had been just that, there'd be no problem. The Bible's not against wealth creation in itself. It doesn't say that you shouldn't be rewarded for hard work and for enterprise and industry. And Isaiah certainly isn't saying here that believing in God and being in business are incompatible. But he does lift the lid off this increasing wealth. He shows us that there's another side to all those very sensible arguments about the use of resources. When we were in Cambridge, we had a garden with a rockery at the back. Well, it was more of a rubble than a rockery, I suppose, to tell you the truth. But those rocks on a summer's day had a sort of pleasing ruggedness to them. They looked so clean and clear-cut, at any rate, if I wasn't mowing the grass. The thing is, when you actually turned them over, it was all pretty grisly. Strange worms that looked like extras from a science fiction movie. A grotty, sort of muddy kind of earth that got under your fingernails. It rapidly became one of my golden rules in Cambridge: don't touch the rockery. Something which I've kept up in the garden here as well. And Judah's business life is just like that rockery. It's okay on one side, but underneath, something pretty nasty is going on. And Isaiah here in verse 8 and 9 turns the rock over for us. He shows us with just a few telling words, like one of those Rolf Harris sketches, what's been involved in this greed for wealth. Because what is involved is the gradual exclusion of all others from the particular area. Look at the second half of verse 8. They add field to field until there is no more room, and you are made to dwell in the midst of the land alone. No more room. No more room for anybody else. You're dwelling alone, and you're not lonely. It's the country house, the mansion, isn't it? Set in acres of empty land. And that's the point. All the other Israelites have been excluded. They've been thrown off the land. As it happens, in the same way as it goes on today, someone forecloses on a loan, gets the property cheap, throws the family off, goes on from there, looks for the next property to foreclose on. But that way of operating was something that was forbidden in Israel by God's law. God had laid down that the Israelites were to have family plots of land, family farms. And he'd laid down that those plots were something that were ultimately to return to the same family. You weren't to lose the land permanently by a loan or a mortgage. It had to come back. And we can see some reasons why God laid that law down. It meant that there was a basic protection for peasant farmers who were operating at the margins to make ends meet. But more than that, it meant that every Israelite family had a stake in the promised land. It was part of the dignity given to every descendant of Abraham that they had a stake in the promised land. That was their personal inheritance, their personal inheritance from God's promise and God's goodness. To take a family off the land, therefore, was to demean them, as well as to expose them to all kinds of pressures economically. And that's why God says woe in verse 8 to these accumulators. He's not objecting to them creating wealth. He's objecting to what's been involved in their wealth creation. Even we feel the force of that sometimes in our imperfection. We didn't object to Robert Maxwell making a fortune. What we objected to was him making a fortune by having his hands in somebody else's pension fund. Their concern for wealth has degenerated into a greed that puts God's laws in the trash can. Now, we've got to be quite careful about applying this to our own situation, because God has not said to us, as he said to the Israelites, that we can't sell or mortgage our ancestral lands, or supposing we've got any. I must admit, the Ovi ancestral lands are pretty thin on the ground. That's a sort of indirect plea for a rise, by the way. But he has said quite a bit about other ethical points that we do have to bear in mind in our own wealth creation. We have to say that it's not legit to exclude the competition's bid by spreading that bit of smear about their work. We've got to be careful about leaving a client with a deliberately false impression about what he's actually going to get from us. The expense account isn't to be the most impressive work of fiction since Dr. Zhivago, because God's given us clear indications that these ways of getting wealth are not on for his people, even though they may be standard practice for the rest of the world. And there's one area that really does demand special mention. That's the field of the employee. One of the features at the back of what Isaiah says is that we should not demean or degrade our fellow men and women. In the light of that, it's very hard, isn't it, to justify some of the management practices we've seen over the last few years. Because we have seen people demeaned, for instance, in the way that they've been made redundant. Not always, but certainly sometimes. We have seen a callous disregard for the basic humanity of people. It's a bit of a giveaway, isn't it, that in the jargon, people are just profit centers, units, factors of production. You shed labor, don't you? You don't put a man on the street. But a unit, of course, is a thing. But a person in God's image is so much more than that. I wonder if we're ready, actually, for what this will cost us. It means perhaps that we personally will be poorer, not matching our greedy neighbours pound for pound in the race around the monopoly board. It may mean that because we say that it does matter how you get your wealth, that we will be poorer. Are you prepared to be poorer? Am I? If we're not, then our legitimate concern for wealth has become a greed for wealth, hasn't it? But greed for wealth isn't the only kind of greed at stake here. We're moving on now to verses 11 and 12, which speak of a second type of greed. Woe to those who rise early in the morning, in verse 11, that they may run after strong drink, who tarry late in the evening till wine inflames them. They have lyre and harp, timbrel and flute, and wine at their feasts, but they do not regard the deeds of the Lord or see the work of his hands. It's a very different kind of greed, a greed for pleasure. Because that's what lies behind these people in verses 11 and 12 with their obsessive concern for alcohol. In some ways, I must admit, I always feel that these blokes sound a good deal more jolly than the sort of grim monopolists that we've just heard about in verse 8. But there's still something obsessive about them. The alarm goes at 6 in the morning, and they're up with a lark and down to the off-license. They're still at it late in the evening, cheering themselves along with a bit of disco music. And at first glance, these characters seem fairly harmless. Pathetic, maybe, but harmless by and large. And again, we've got to look closely at what it is exactly that Isaiah's got on his mind here. He's not knocking wine and alcohol as such. They're gifts of God in creation, with a constructive use for human pleasure, within limits. It's not even that Isaiah's averse to early starts and late nights, or that he's anti-music. What's on his mind is the blindness there is to God's word and his works. Second half of verse 12. They do not regard the deeds of the Lord or see the work of his hands. And that's come about, hasn't it? Because the concern for pleasure has become a greed for it. Something that actually overrides everything else. When I first went up to my college, there was a set of rooms next door to mine. It was a very interesting set of rooms, painted blue. It had been painted blue, I should point out, at the end of the 19th century. Underneath that blue paint on the wall, there was a mural going back to the 1750s. It was a beautiful set of murals. It was about the foundation of my college. And the man who'd been there at the end of the 19th century didn't like murals, and he did like blue paint. And he just painted them over. When we actually sort of started to find out about it and the paint started to come off, we couldn't believe it, that something so beautiful had just been painted over and obliterated. And in the same way, this greed for pleasure has painted over everything else. And ironically, it's even painted over the recollection of the God who made this pleasure possible. They do not regard the deeds of the Lord or see the work of his hands. Well, who was it who made the vine from which the grapes came for the wine? Who was it who gave the artistic talent that made the music possible? who was it who'd put the Israelites into the promised land, into the land where the vine grew? It was God also who'd protected Judah from her enemies, so that the hands of the musicians were on the timbrel and the lyre and the harp, and not on the sword and the spear. The greed for pleasure has become so intense that they've forgotten the God who gives the pleasure. One of the things that I find slightly trying every now and again about the family Christmases and the extended Obi family is the way that one of my nephews will take the present from you, immediately unwrap it, and that's it. You won't get a look in for the rest of the day, even though my sister and my brother-in-law are sort of busy sort of slapping him around the head saying, come on, say thank you, you ungrateful little wretch, or words to that effect. Normally it's a bit more forceful than that, after the first hour. And that's rather the sense here. The gift has obliterated the giver. And of course, the pleasure that's given isn't always bad. It's just that it's pursued with this tunnel vision. And I don't know about you, but it strikes me that this greed for pleasure is an even more acute danger for us than the greed for wealth. The financial debacle of the last few years has at least made us a little wary over wealth. But it hasn't over pleasure. In lots of ways, ours has become a culture, hasn't it, where pleasure is the overriding concern, or even the overwriting concern. If it gives pleasure to sleep with a woman who's not your wife, then the attitude is, go for it. If it's pleasure to pop a pill or get plastered, then why not? If it's pleasure to hire a snuff movie for the evening, then it's silly not to. And heaven help anyone who tries to interfere with our pleasures. Of course, they're Puritans, they're killjoys, they're uncool, they're repressed, they're narrow, they're intolerant. And it's very much also with us, that attitude in the church. Someone who's unrepentantly sexually immoral says, I want to be a priest. And we find it very hard as a church to say no to that demand for pleasure. We find it hard to come to church sometimes if there's a decent film on. That's pleasure coming first. We cut down on our quiet times because they're hard work, and we prefer the instant pleasure of Barbara Taylor Bradford or Jeffrey Archer. If, of course, you can describe Jeffrey Archer in any sense as pleasure. Pleasure has become so important that unless we get that instant fix from something, then we ditch it. Now, of course, there's a right place for pleasure. But all this is a greed for pleasure. Again, it's worth asking ourselves, what pleasure, major or minor, do I deny myself for God's sake? The tragedy with both these types of greed is that greed cheats. It doesn't ultimately satisfy. That's anticipated for us in verse 10. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield but one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield but an ephah. What he's describing there is the way that these huge farms, these agri-businesses, in fact produce a microscopic harvest. It's reinforced for us in verse 13 through to 16. Therefore my people go into exile for want of knowledge, in verse 13. Isaiah's introducing for us there the result of this greed. With that therefore. These people have been so consumed by greed that they've lost touch with God, and they don't know him, and therefore they're given over to exile. Their society is abandoned to destruction by God. That's the force of verse 13 and 14. And that's just what did happen to Judah. She was given over ultimately to the Babylonian armies. And the ironic result is that those who'd been so greedy for wealth are dispossessed and go hungry. Verse 9, surely many houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without an inhabitant. The honored men who'd boasted about their harvests are dying of hunger, in verse 13. Those who've been so greedy for the pleasure of alcohol are thirsty. greedy for wealth, greedy for pleasure. Now these people have been consumed by their greed, cheated by it. It's promised them satisfaction, and ultimately it's failed to deliver. And no wonder. This greed has excluded the God who'd made the pleasure and the wealth possible. And in excluding him, it signed its own death warrant. It's like turning off the pump at the oil well. After a while, you can't expect oil to flow, to go on flowing through the pipeline. And all that is highly uncomfortable for our culture. We put so much of ourselves into our pursuit of wealth and pleasure. And it's extremely threatening to see Isaiah debunk that as he does here. And yet it rings true. We know that earthly wealth and earthly pleasure don't last. If nothing else, they're ended by death. And that's the tragedy of the greedy soul, whose greed has painted over the knowledge of God, who's obliterated all trace of personal relationship with him. At the end, they're left with nothing. And again, tragically, that's a monument to God's justice. They have refused to acknowledge him, and he respects that refusal. That's why, in verse 16, Isaiah reminds us of the justice of God, straight after he's told us of the fall of greedy Jerusalem and grasping Judah. And Judah and Jerusalem model for us what happens to us and to our culture, our friends, our relations, unless we say goodbye to greed. That's why, isn't it, Contact 94 in a month or so's time is so vital. We are offering people a chance, aren't we, to say goodbye to that creed of greed and welcome the creed of God, knowing that it's only in the creed of God that all these concerns and all these appetites can properly be met. Let's pray.